So for decades, computing felt a lot like operating one of those old school telephone switchboards.
Oh, yeah, like the giant wall of wires.
Exactly. If you wanted to actually accomplish a task, you physically had to plug a specific cord into a very specific jack.
Right.
Like, you want an email sent, you have to open the app, formulate the syntax, hit send. You want to find a file, you are digging through, endless hierarchical folders, just double clicking until you strike gold.
Yeah, the human is basically the bridging mechanism for every single digital action.
Yes, the bottleneck, essentially.
Completely. In that historical model, you are micromanaging the raw compute. I mean, the machine has processing power, but it has zero agency.
But that switchboard is starting to plug in its own cords. And that is exactly the world we are stepping into today. We are taking the July 1st, 2026 edition of the Tech Trends newsletter, and we are extracting the absolute most critical insights just for you. Because today, our mission is to see how this shift toward autonomous computing is rewiring everything, from massive leaps in AI productivity to the actual physical shape of mobile hardware, right up to the wild frontier of global digital finance.
And we are going to look strictly at the underlying mechanics here, the why and the how behind these massive shifts. The goal is so that you can walk into your next strategy meeting with a really concrete understanding of the paradigm shifts happening right beneath our feet.
Okay, let's unpack this because I want to start with Google.
Sure.
They just rolled out what might be the most aggressive productivity update of the year, bringing Ask Gemini to mobile Google Drive for iOS and Android, anchored by a feature called AI Overviews.
Yeah, and for anyone following the space, a search bar in a cloud drive is obviously not new.
Right.
But the underlying mechanism here is fundamentally different. Imagine you have a dense, like 50-page financial PDF on your phone.
Oh, the worst.
Exactly. The legacy experience is downloading it, waiting for the rendering, and then that friend pinched to zoom scrolling just to find one specific metric.
Which is such a massive friction point, especially if you're on a mobile device.
It really is. So what Ask Gemini is doing relies on a localized retrieval augmented generation, or REAG architecture.
Okay, our ridge.
Yeah. Instead of just matching keywords in a search index, the system is actively reading the document's contents. It's understanding the semantic context of your query and synthesizing a 3 to 5 line natural language summary right at the top of your screen.
Wow, okay.
So you just ask, what was our Q3 marketing spend in the ENE region? And it extracts the data without you ever even opening the file.
That's incredible.
And internal metrics from Google were showing this cuts file browsing time by 40%.
40%. That time savings is massive. But I have to think for enterprise users, the actual functionality usually takes a backseat to security, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Because for the last few years, the biggest roadblock for corporate AI adoption hasn't been the capability, it's been the fear of proprietary data leakage.
And that is the critical unlock here. Google engineered this with a very strict privacy-first architecture. The contents of your enterprise files are explicitly ring-fenced.
Okay, so they aren't floating around in the cloud for anyone to see.
Right. They are processed to generate the summary for you, but they are never ingested into the foundational model's training data.
Got it.
That specific architectural guarantee, localizing the context window without feeding the global brain, is really the only reason Fortune 500 compliance departments are finally greenlighting this technology.
That makes total sense. And Google is taking that exact same logic and pushing it to the desktop now.
Yes, they are.
They just dropped Gemini Spark natively onto macOS, and the industry is heavily leaning into this term right now, agentic AI.
Right, agentic.
And I want to try an analogy here for you because I think people sometimes conflate chatbots with
They
agents.
definitely do.
So traditional AI, the chatbots we've used for the last few years, feels like a brilliant but highly literal intern.
Exactly.
You have to micromanage the sequence. You tell it, find this file, then draft an email based on this file, then open my calendar and tell me when I'm free.
Step by tedious step.
Exactly. But agentic AI feels like a proactive chief of staff. You just supply the terminal goal. You say, set up a team meeting for tomorrow at 3 p.m. and prep the agenda based on last week's notes, and it just executes the entire sequence.
What's fascinating here is the technical leap required to make that chief of staff analogy an actual reality.
Right.
We are moving from human-computer interaction to human-computer delegation.
Delegation, yeah.
And to achieve that, Gemini Spark relies on two specific mechanisms: chain of thought reasoning and tool use.
Okay, let's pop the hood on those. How does it actually execute that sequence without me holding its hand?
So chain-of-thought reasoning basically means the AI model can autonomously decompose a high-level ambiguous goal into a structured sequence of logical subtasks. It intrinsically maps out that to schedule a meeting, it first must query the availability matrix, then draft a calendar payload, then send it, and finally synthesize an agenda document.
So it's making its own to-do list, basically.
Precisely. But the real magic is the second part, tool use.
Right.
The AI has the active ability to interface with different APIs. It generates the correct JSON payloads to actually talk to your calendar, your email client, and your project management software. It basically acts as the orchestration layer between all your isolated software silos.
And it's contextually aware of the operating system itself.
Right. Exactly.
Like if I'm drafting a message in Slack, Gemini Spark recognizes the active application state and can autonomously pull a relevant Google Sheet I was literally just looking at.
It's completely seamless.
And the early pilot data is just wild.
Yeah.
One Fortune 500 company reported an average of 6.5 hours saved per employee on routine administrative tasks.
Over 6 hours. Think about that.
We are talking about handing back almost a full working day to every single person on the payroll.
It's massive.
But I have to push back on the utopian vision here for a second.
Okay, let's hear it.
If we have this digital chief of staff handling all the connective tissue of our day, pulling the files, sending the invites, routing the data, do we lose visibility into how our own business actually operates?
That's a very real concern.
Right. Like, if the AI is running the switchboard, do we lose the thread of our own projects?
Well, that tension is going to define enterprise management for the next decade. Organizations are going to have to adopt a completely new operational paradigm.
How so?
You are no longer managing your time. You are managing your agent's parameters.
Oh, that's an interesting way to put it.
Because the system utilizes machine learning to adapt to your specific working style, it essentially becomes a black box of efficiency. The risk you're pointing out is very real. If a user doesn't understand the limitations of the agent's logic, they might blindly trust a hallucinated calendar invite or a completely misrouted financial summary.
Yeah, that could be disastrous. But, you know, if we're delegating administrative logic and scheduling, the inevitable next frontier is delegating pure creation.
Oh, without a doubt.
And that brings us to the visual content disruption that was highlighted in the Tekken editorial note.
Yes.
We are seeing the scale of automation hit creative industries in a way that fundamentally alters the economics of media.
The bottleneck is no longer human creativity, really. It's compute cost.
Right.
And that cost is approaching zero.
It's wild. Let's look at Google's new public API, Gemini OmniFlash. It essentially turns complex video production into a text-based conversation.
Yeah.
Let's assume you know how tedious traditional video editing is. The hours spent cutting clips, syncing audio, rendering graphics.
It's exhausting.
OmniFlash bypasses all of that. You literally just feed it a raw video asset and prompt it. You say, condense this to 30 seconds for TikTok, track the subject, add upbeat music, and overlay our brand watermark.
It just does it.
The API executes the entire pipeline in minutes.
But the underlying economics here are the real story.
Yeah.
Think about the legacy cost structure. A human editor handling a multi-stage pipeline costs anywhere from $50 to $200 an hour.
Easily.
And a polished 60-second spot easily eats up a half day of labor.
Right.
But because Google has optimized the inference efficiency of their video generation models so much, they are pricing OmniFlash at 10 cents per second of output.
Wait, 10 cents. So a 60-second video costs $6 and takes 10 minutes.
Exactly.
You are literally stripping hundreds of dollars and hours of latency out of a single piece of content.
And we are seeing the exact same collapse in marginal costs for still images, too, with the release of Nano Banana 2 Lite.
Oh, right, which the industry officially designates as Gemini 3.1 Flashlight, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And this model is engineered around a really specific architecture called distilled diffusion.
I've seen that term floating around. How does distilled diffusion actually drive the price down so radically?
Well, traditional diffusion models, the ones we've used for the last couple of years, they work by taking an image of pure static noise and iteratively removing the noise step by step until an image appears.
Right, kind of like carving a statue out of marble.
Exactly. But that iterative process requires massive amounts of GPU compute. Distillation essentially takes a massive teacher model and uses it to train a smaller, highly efficient student model.
Okay, so teaching the smaller model.
Right. The student model learns to map the initial noise directly to the final image in just one or two steps, completely skipping that slow, iterative rendering process.
So it's like a master painter teaching an apprentice how to capture a landscape in a single brush stroke instead of like 50 layers of oil paint.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. And because they've eliminated the computational latency, this model generates a 1024 by 1024 pixel image in roughly 4 seconds.
4 seconds. Wow.
And it features deep multilingual prompt support too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, specifically noting Persian language capabilities, which instantly unlocks massive, previously underserved global markets.
That's huge.
But the distillation process drops the compute cost so low that the API pricing is almost absurd. It's $0.034 per 1,000 images.
Okay, let's do that math for a second. A startup with a marketing budget of $100 can generate approximately 3 million unique images.
3 million, yeah.
But this is where I get stuck. At $100 for 3 million images, does this actually democratize creativity for small businesses? Or does it just guarantee that the internet is about to become an overwhelming, endless sea of generic AI-generated fast food content?
It's a very valid concern.
Like, if everyone can generate infinite content for pennies, doesn't the value of the content just drop to zero?
Well, the tech and editorial analysis raises that exact structural concern.
Yeah.
Yes, the image generation moves from being a massive cost center to just a negligible line item.
Right.
A small e-commerce brand can instantly spin up 1,000 lifestyle shots for a new product. It entirely upends the traditional stock photography and entry-level graphic design markets.
Absolutely.
But the Tekken note highlights the incoming bottleneck, which is brand coherence.
Ah, keeping the visual identity consistent when you are outputting millions of assets.
Precisely the issue. When generation is free, curation becomes the premium skill. How do you ensure the lighting, the color grading, and the specific brand aesthetics remain perfectly coherent across 3 million images?
That sounds like a nightmare, honestly.
It is. Generating a pretty picture is now a commodity. Generating a highly specific brand-aligned visual ecosystem at scale is the new challenge.
Which means all of this frictionless content creation creates a new physical bottleneck. Where do we actually manage it?
Exactly.
You can't orchestrate a 3 million image ad campaign or effectively delegate complex workflows to an agentic AI on a standard, narrow smartphone screen.
No, you really can't.
The physical canvas has to adapt to the software.
Which perfectly explains the highly aggressive, somewhat cryptic move Samsung just made regarding their upcoming Galaxy Z Fold 8 and Flip 8 devices.
Yeah, they pulled a page right out of the hype cycle playbook.
They really did.
They completely wiped their entire Instagram account, years of marketing history, just gone overnight.
Oof.
And they replaced it with a single clean slate campaign centered around the tagline, "New shape, new joy."
It is a massive signaling mechanism. They are hitting a hard reset to draw the industry's undivided attention to a very specific hardware pivot that addresses a foundational user complaint.
And here's where it gets really interesting. For years, the Achilles heel of the Fold devices was the external screen.
Oh, it was so cramped.
Right. When the phone was closed, it had a 23 by 9 aspect ratio, which is incredibly narrow. Using it felt like trying to text a novel through a tiny mail slot in a front door.
Aha, that's incredibly accurate.
You basically had to unfold the phone to do anything productive.
Right.
But the leaks now confirm they are widening the folded screen from 62 millimeters to 68 millimeters, shifting it to a much more standard 20 by 9 aspect ratio.
A huge deal.
But I have to ask, we're talking about 6 millimeters of glass here.
Yes.
In the grand scheme of consumer tech, is a 6 millimeter difference really enough to drive a massive marketing reset and change human behavior?
Well, in the realm of mobile ergonomics and user interface design, 6 millimeters completely alters the interactive matrix.
Really? Just 6 millimeters?
Absolutely. It changes the size of the virtual keyboard, it prevents third-party apps from letterboxing, and it shifts the device from a cramped, compromised state into a natural, conventional smartphone experience.
Okay, I see.
But we have to view this hardware shift through the lens of the AI orchestration we just discussed. The hardware industry is basically conceding that AI requires a dual-state device.
Dual state. Walk me through that user flow. What does that actually look like?
Think about the daily cadence. With that wider 68-millimeter external screen, you can comfortably execute quick, low-friction interactions.
Like checking emails.
Exactly. You check an AI overview summary of a PDF, you reply to a message, you triage notifications, all without opening the device.
Right.
But when you need to deploy Gemini Spark to architect a multi-stage workflow, or when you are reviewing a massive batch of OmniFlash video edits, You unfold the device.
Ah.
You unleash the AI on that massive tablet-sized internal display for high-density multitasking. The physical hardware is splitting into two distinct modes. Quick input on the outside and agentic delegation on the inside.
That makes total sense. And the strategic timing is ruthless, by the way.
Oh, incredibly ruthless.
Samsung is pushing their Unpacked event to July, actively attempting to front-run the news cycle and capture wallet share before Apple's expected iPhone 18 launch in September.
It's a calculated strike to establish dominance in the AI hardware space for the second half of 2026.
So we have software decentralizing our workflows and hardware morphing to give us better access to those tools. But these same foundational principles, specifically decentralization, blockchain, and automated protocols, are actively rewriting the rules at the absolute highest levels of global finance and political policy, too.
Yeah. The intersection of cryptocurrency and sovereign national strategy is rapidly becoming the defining economic story of the decade.
Now, let's look at the financial data that just dropped. And I want to be super clear with you, the listener, right here at the start.
Yes, very important.
We aren't looking at this to take political sides today. Our focus is strictly on the collision course between regulatory policy and these new digital asset classes, exactly as outlined in the Impartial Tikkun editorial analysis.
Exactly. We're just reporting the landscape.
Right. But the raw numbers here are simply staggering.
The catalyst for this discussion is President Donald Trump's recently released legally mandated financial disclosure, which revealed over $1.2 billion in cryptocurrency-related earnings and holdings.
Over a billion. Let's break down that portfolio because it shows a deep integration into various sectors of Web3.
It really does.
It includes $50 million in raw Bitcoin, which maps to roughly 600 BTC. It shows a massive $535 million in consulting fees derived from blockchain projects. There is $200 million tied up in NFTs and another $50 million in real estate tokenization.
That last point, the real estate tokenization, is particularly noteworthy.
How so?
Well, it indicates engagement with smart contracts that fractionalize physical real estate assets on a blockchain, completely bypassing traditional escrow and title companies.
Oh, wow.
And the broader market reaction to this disclosure was immediate. Bitcoin surged 3%. Pushing past the $85,500 mark.
Because explicit documented support from a sitting executive leader signals to the market that digital assets have moved from the fringe to the institutional center.
Exactly.
But the Tikkun analysis highlights the massive debate this triggers. On one hand, critics are raising alarms about a glaring conflict of interest. Like, if a leader holds a $1.2 billion personal stake in a decentralized industry, how can they impartially regulate it?
That's the primary critique.
But then conversely, supporters argue that a leader who actually holds DeFi protocols and tokenized assets possesses a rare practical understanding of how this complex plumbing actually functions.
And we are seeing that practical understanding translate into highly specific, disruptive policy proposals.
What kind of proposals?
The administration is floating proposals to significantly reduce capital gains taxes on crypto assets.
Okay.
The strategic goal there is to incentivize blockchain startups to remain domiciled in the United States, halting the brain drain to jurisdictions with friendlier tax frameworks like Singapore or Switzerland.
Keeping the talent here. They are also proposing the creation of a dedicated crypto regulatory framework that completely bypasses the SEC's traditional securities laws.
Yes.
Essentially admitting that a digital token doesn't fit the legal definition of a 1930s stock certificate.
Which is a huge shift in legal perspective.
But the proposal that completely stops me in my tracks is the idea of establishing a strategic U.S. Bitcoin reserve, functionally treating it like we treat the national gold reserve.
Yeah, that's a big one.
So what does this all mean? How do you take a currency Bitcoin, whose entire founding philosophy, its literal cypherpunk reason for existing, is to be borderless and immune to government control, and use it to build a centralized national government-controlled strategic reserve? Isn't that an inherent massive contradiction?
This raises an important question, and it cuts straight to the core tension of the current era. It is the clash between decentralized cryptographic technology and the cold realities of sovereign game theory.
Game theory, yeah.
You really have to look at the global board to understand the U.S. position here.
Okay, let's look at it.
So, China has taken an authoritarian approach, implementing sweeping bans on cryptocurrency trading and mining to maintain strict capital controls.
Right. While the European Union went the opposite route with the MiCA framework.
Correct. The Markets in Crypto Assets framework. the EU created a highly comprehensive traditional regulatory wrapper for digital assets.
Okay, so it's very structured.
It provides incredible legal certainty, but critics argue it is so dense it risks stifling wild, iterating innovation. The U.S. is currently caught in the middle trying to figure out its specific strategic countermove.
It's a high-stakes balancing act.
Absolutely. The U.S. policy tension requires balancing the absolute necessity of consumer protection, you know, preventing fraud, and mitigating systemic economic risk from market volatility against the very real threat of regulating the next generation of financial infrastructure entirely out of existence.
Right. If you regulate too hard, they just move to Singapore.
Exactly. So a strategic Bitcoin reserve, despite being philosophically contradictory to the asset's anarchist origins, would serve as a definitive, unignorable anchor.
Interesting.
It would declare to the global market that the U.S. intends to aggressively lead, rather than passively follow, in the digital asset arms race.
Wow. You know, it is incredible to pull all these seemingly disparate threads together for you. We started by looking at a world where agentic AI workflows are taking over the connective administrative tissue of our daily jobs.
Yep.
We moved into a creative landscape where models like Distilled Diffusion can generate millions of visual assets for literal pennies, fundamentally changing the economics of media.
And forcing us to adapt.
Exactly. Mm. We saw how the physical hardware in our pockets, like the widening galaxy fold, is literally changing shape to act as a dual state orchestration tool for these new capabilities.
It all connects.
And finally, we see how the underlying digital architecture of decentralization is forcing global superpowers to rewrite financial policy and national reserves. Everything we touched on today is deeply connected.
It really is an interwoven ecosystem. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a thought to mull over as you head into your day.
Okay, what is it?
Across all of these distinct stories, what we are truly watching is the rapid, unprecedented automation of trust.
Automation of trust. I want to make sure I'm following you. How are we automating trust?
Well, consider the mechanisms we've discussed today. If Gemini Spark is acting as an autonomous agent, interfacing with APIs to spend your company's capital to book flights and schedule logistics.
Right.
And decentralized crypto protocols are automatically executing complex financial contracts without a bank acting as an intermediary.
Ah, I see where you're going.
Who is accountable when the code inevitably makes a mistake.
Wow.
When a system hallucinates a purchase or a smart contract contains a logic flaw that drains a wallet, where does the liability fall? As our technology becomes exponentially more autonomous and capable of independent action, pure, legally binding human accountability becomes the ultimate scarce resource in the digital economy.
Human accountability is the ultimate scarce resource. That really takes us right back to that old school switchboard operator we talked about at the beginning of the deep dive.
It really does.
The switchboard might be plugging in its own cords now. The machine might be running the entire sequence itself. But at the end of the line, you are still the one who has to answer the phone and own the consequences of the call.
Exactly. The delegation of work does not equal the delegation of responsibility.
Well, we hope this deep dive has given you some powerful structural insights to take into your day, your next meeting, or just your next conversation. Thank you so much for joining us, for being that crucial third person in the room and exploring the mechanics of tomorrow with us. Stay curious and have an incredibly productive and energizing day.